If you're ready to confront your destiny, if this is the moment that you've been praying for, tune in and listen to your cosmic cheerleader, Commander Lady Athena, for cosmic pep talks for closet Christ. The show is the voice of the Ashtar Command. The call is for you to step forward into your greatness. Be listening on Wednesday. We have an appointment with destiny.
Greetings in the divine love, that is, that we all are. I'm Commander Lady Athena, and you're listening to the voice of the Ashtar Command, Cosmic Pep Talks for Closet Christs. This evening, our seminar topic is letting go of control and allowing loving presence to orchestrate our life. So, if you're ready, let's take a deep breath and call yourself forward as that living love, that divine presence, and just allow it to inhabit your present nowness. Let's take another deep breath and just feel it coming in like warm honey, pouring right down through your chakra system to the center of your head, flowing down your spine, flowing out through your nervous system, drenching every cell of your body with the holy fire of your divine essence. And let's chant the Hue, the ancient name for God, that helps to spiritualize the consciousness and clear from it any of the clutter and the mental debris. Take a deep breath. Hue. Energy through your body. I experienced it just now as a tremendous fiery heat going down through my arms and hands and back, down to my feet. And perhaps you're experiencing that as well. So we live and move and have our existence in divine love. We're like waves of the cosmic ocean of living love. And that living love lives and moves and sources through each one of us as existence itself. We are in divine love, and divine love inhabits us as our very life, as eternal existence. We are the very transduction coils, the inlets, the instruments to which that loving creative intelligence finds expression on Earth. And we are the only means by which that creative, divine, and loving intelligence finds conscious expression on Earth. Only the Hue man can have conscious awareness of the divine essence and be a conscious co-participant in its sourcing and flowing through the mind-body instrument. We can choose to be that conduit. And thus we have unlimited power and potential. However, that lies mainly dormant and is thus untapped by the majority of Earth's inhabitants. So to be a disciple or an initiate or light bearer means that one is beginning to awaken to that dormant potential. And the more we bring ourselves, our personal lives, into alignment with that higher divine potential that's always present as an option, the more we bring ourselves into alignment with that, the more that begins to activate and come alive within our lives. And each of our seminars is another nudge into that greater awakened awareness, into greater love and loving expression. For the divine source is formless presence, experienced as unconditional love. Simply put, God is love, and spirituality is loving. It's nothing but loving. So, it must have been around the age of 8 when I came to realize that things in life usually didn't turn out as I'd expected. And this fascinated me, even as it gave rise to fear at life's unpredictability. And although I didn't realize it at the time, I began to actually practice mindful observation. I would write down in my diary what I wanted to have happen. And then I'd write as many possible outcomes as I could come up with. Really, my motive was to circumvent the possibility of unanticipated disappointment. I was trying to gird myself up that I wouldn't be disappointed. And I reasoned rather superstitiously that if I could think of every possible outcome that could possibly occur, nothing could happen that I wasn't prepared for. However, I soon came to realize that as many outcomes as I could imagine, something else entirely unexpected most often occurred. I was attempting to control the outcome of events in my life, and at the same time, I was realizing there always seemed to be an unexpected element that would intervene. So I would write down what I wanted to have happen, and then what actually did take place. And over time, it became obvious that the unexpected outcomes usually produced an even better result than my original hope for outcome. And moreover, as the years went by, I could clearly see how each event was necessary to get me to the next place in life that I was meant to be. So there appeared to be an overall plan, and my life was unfolding perfectly according to that high plan. And I began to sense a strong guiding presence, which I often referred to as the hand of God upon my head. Now, my teenage years, from the age of 13 to 20, were spent as a circus performer doing dangerous aerial and equestrian stunts. And so this sense of guiding, guarding presence was extremely comforting and reassuring. So experience followed experience as I kept track of the choices I made in life and the resulting outcome. When I made the most loving, faith-imbued choices, the outcome was always positive and beneficial in the long run for everyone involved. And some of the choices meant my leaving a certain place, person, or relationship, which at the time may have produced tears and considerable heartache and upheaval. But based on results, turned out to be exactly what I was meant to do according to a higher orchestration. I also noticed that invariably, when I had to make that drastic choice, I was tested. I would be surrounded by the witnessing voices at the time that nearly always were ones of warning of a dire outcome if I took that choice of action. Thus, each choice was surrounded by voices of fear and negation, to where I had to choose to either obey my heart and inner sense of rightness, or allow the many naysayers to control me through fear. And this taught me to always trust my heart, to trust my better judgment, my conscience, my sense of what was right and appropriate. And whenever I did that and acted in good faith and from a loving intention, things would always turn out right. So I think probably you can all recall a time when you thought you couldn't go on. You simply couldn't live without a certain person in your life. But they left, and you did go on, often to something even better in your next cycle of life. So if you're observant, you come to realize everything in life is only for a time and a season, and that all things here in this level are impermanent and ever-changing. So resistance to what is taking place in one's life is futile. It only creates, you know, totally unnecessary suffering. We need to learn to yield to the winds of change like the willow tree. We need to accept that this is what is happening now, and then see how we can cooperate for the best possible outcome in any given situation. So acceptance and cooperation will often totally disarm an adversarial energy, for there's no opposite polarity for adversarial energy to play off of. Adversarial energy is always ego-spawned. It comes out of that lower, limited part of ourselves. That's the eternal negative self-talk that we run in our heads. It's that, I would say, slayer of every iota of joy that we have if we allow it to do that. So you don't want to take wise counsel from an ignoramus, and the ego mind is the biggest ignoramus going. So don't take counsel from that negative self-talk that goes on in your mind. Remember, it takes two opposing energies to create discord, conflict, war, whatever. For example, when couples fight, the argument ends when one of the couples falls silent or refuses to fight back. So the power of a soft, gentle response totally disempowers an angry accusation. It's amazing. I've tried this time and time again, where someone is going off and they're in your face and they're shouting and yelling and carrying on. And you will say something, or I would say something like, "Oh, I'm sorry," or "I love you," or "Thank you for caring, you know, so much." But whatever you are led by the Spirit to say at that moment will totally take it in a different direction than if you had tried to defend yourself or had gone into your ego mode and shouted in return or whatever. And I also notice how often this diffused potentially altercative situations while I was in India. Now, when you live in India, things often break down and almost predictably don't work out as planned. And invariably, when you're in that situation, the person that you're with would throw up their hands in the air and shrug and say, what to do? What to do? And it was so sweet and so innocent and so defenseless that you absolutely couldn't get mad. Because indeed, what is one to do when, having done one's best, still things work out the way they work out? And not usually according to what we had planned. So if anything, living in India or a similar culture will certainly teach you to be patient, to cooperate with what's going on, to accept what's going on, and most of all, to have a lighthearted humor about it all, because you know what? None of it matters. None of it matters at all. It's just not important, because we are not material beings. We're spiritual beings having a very limited immersion in material experiences. But it's not who we are, it's not what we are, and it's not what matters. What matters is that we bring the loving, the spirituality, into the occasion wherever we find ourselves. So Sai Baba has told us that if we surrender to God fully and completely, with no trace of ego, that God will bear the full burden of our welfare, that God will take care of all the little details if we surrender fully with no trace of ego. What does that mean? To surrender to the divine with no trace of ego means without any notion of separate existence apart from God. And that's a different interpretation of the ego, isn't it? A different interpretation of surrender. We usually think of surrender as, oh, well, I have to follow that person and do everything they say. No. No God-realized being, no avatar, wants followers. They want you to wake up to the reality that you are the same as they are. The only difference, they have realized it, and we have not. Unless, of course, we have. There may be some of you listening that have. So to surrender to the divine with no trace of ego means without any notion of separate existence apart from God. So it's only our ego-based notions that hold us separate from fully partaking of that greater life, of that divine grace, and all that is seeking to source through us. For example, the notion that we've been indoctrinated in, life after life, is the notion that God exists apart from us, somewhere up on high, or in the great central sun system, or Shambhala, or in some other location on the planet, or in some other form than our own. So we have to decondition that conditioning. We have to let it go. We have to thank it for serving us, and it's no longer needed in that capacity, and bid it adieu. So to truly love means to embody presence. It is to be fully whole, fully present with the divine essence, fully occupying one's physical temple and life expression. So living in the presence is total unguarded openness to the divine, to the way things unfold and orchestrate in, through, and around you. And that love is never an act. It's never a doing. It's a state of being. It's to live as the divine spirit, as the very embodiment of the divine that you truly are. Now that love, that pure love, has neither reason nor season, no beginning and no ending. Love with a reason, a season, or because is conditioned. It's not pure love. If you say to someone, well, I love you because, no, that's not love. That's attachment, desire, expectation. And that is the kind of love that dissipates when those expectations and those desires are not met. So love has no element of neediness, no lust, no personal element whatsoever. Love, true divine love, transcends the personal element entirely. It is ever pure, ever present, without boundaries, without conditions. Love is God. And love is what we are in any given moment when we are embodying our truest essence. Now, they showed me something the other day in meditation that I thought was really interesting. I was told that whatever action arises from pure love alone can be defined as moral or as dharma or right action. That morality is the natural expression of one that's been imbued with divine love, that lives from divine presence. For such a person, immorality and sin is impossible. Now, if you read the Bhagavad Gita with that in mind, you will understand why Lord Krishna instructed Arjuna, the warrior in the battlefield, to engage in warfare with his kith and kindred, to do his dharma, not to be wishy-washy, not to vacillate. What does that mean? Well, symbolically, even though this was a historical event, symbolically it meant that we have to have the moral courage to let go of those voices, those momentums, those impulses that arise from the ego, the false self. We have to be ruthless in destroying them. And the war we wage is with the pure light. For example, when you see the Greek gods and goddesses that have the implements, like they have the spears or the tridents, or they'll have the various implements of war, those are always symbolic of piercing through illusion with the swords and spears of light. So they're extensions of the energy field of that god or goddess in mythology to slay the only enemies you'll ever find, which are within your own mind. There's no outer dragon to be slayed. There's just the dragon that's dragging its butt from being fully yielded to spirit. So if you want to train your dragon, you train your mind to let go of control and allow the hosting of the presence, which fulfills, orchestrates, and arranges all things divinely, perfectly, with everyone and everything benefited and enhanced in the process. No one loses when you're hosting divine love. So, giving over whatever we are involved with to that higher orchestration, while at the same time giving it our full impeccable attention, is what we're called to do as we act in life. impeccability is always the sign of the spiritual warrior. We act impeccably. We follow through with commitments that we've placed out there. And we complete what we have set in motion. Absolutely must do that. Because otherwise, when you transition into the fourth dimension, you're going to be faced with all of your incompletions. And you're going to have to complete them all before you're allowed to pass beyond that. Or you have to get to the place inside yourself where you can relinquish the doership so totally that you can pronounce it completed. But you can't lie to yourself. Your inner self knows when you're holding something against yourself. It's really wise not to make commitments that are projected way into your future. Always allow yourself some wiggle room. God willing, inshallah, if God wills, you know, whatever. If I'm still on the planet, you know, always leave yourself some wiggle room to opt out if you're not able to fulfill that. Don't set laws up that bind you to time. Don't make commitments to material things. Commit only to spirit. If you commit to spirit, that you can take wherever you may move in and through the cosmos. But if you're committed to material things, then you have to return to a material world or universe to fulfill those commitments. To catch my drift? So there are ways of embodying presence that maybe you haven't considered, but are extremely telling. Telling in the way that you're either present or you're not. One of the things that's very telling is to give full attention to whoever is speaking. When someone is speaking to you, give them your full attention. Don't be on your iPhone or whatever. Don't be watching TV. Don't have your eyes looking someplace else. Give them eye contact, open body posture, no crossed arms across your chest, none of that. Sit up, give them eye contact, full attention, and listen. Fully listen. You have to be in spiritual presence to fully listen. Most of the time, we only half listen, waiting for an opportunity to interrupt, interject, contradict, give voice to our opinion, our objections, defend or dispute what's being said, all arising, of course, from inattentiveness and ego. So you can start out by beginning to notice whenever you do that, and just practice bringing yourself fully present, and just simply listen. I really believe this is what Jesus was referring to when he used the example of people having ears but not hearing and eyes but not seeing. So the ego mind filters all information through past conditioning and its likes and dislikes, its attachments to gathered notions and personal opinions. So just practice noticing the details of everything in your environment. Just notice without commentary. Wherever you happen to be, pay attention, be present, take it all in, without mentally defining, naming, or running internal commentary. Simply noticing. Without thought. simply noticing without thinking about what you're seeing is practicing awareness or mindfulness. It's to stay in the witnessing self. Now, the same applies to listening without needing to offer comment. Another approach is to only reply or give suggestions when you are asked directly to do so. Too often, we who are in the capacity of serving as counselors or teachers or mentors or way-showers, we think we must always offer solutions and answers to people's problems. It almost goes with the turf. We feel like, well, that's why people are talking to us. They're going to want us to give them some advice. But I came to realize that so often people only want to tell their story, but they're really not interested in doing anything about it or changing it or improving it. Why? Well, because they've used the story to define who they are and their lives. Their lives are wrapped around that story. You take away the story, you fix their problem, and they no longer, in their terms and definitions, have a life or any purpose. So you have to let people be where they are until they're not, and do what they do until they don't. And meanwhile, you have to take care of your own 10 acres, and usually that's a full-time job. So for many people, their issue is their life, around which their whole attention and their whole focus revolves. So keeping that problem or issue intact is very important to them, more important than you bringing up a solution or an answer that would remove their issue or problem. Or, worse yet, give them the responsibility to do something about it rather than talk about it. The ego hates that. You've made it wrong. You've revealed it for what it is, a big delaying tactic. So examples of things that people use to define their lives would be an addictive pattern, or perhaps a childhood abuse or some trauma that happened, or depression, personal struggle, illness. I had a woman one time object to being healed because she had just purchased a beautiful, to her, motorized wheelchair. I was like, well, I can't be healed. I just got this, spent all this money to get this motorized wheelchair. And I looked at her, and I was like, wow, okay, we'll have at it. Other issues might be gender identity. That's a big thing for many people. I wonder how much of a problem that would be if they realized that we change sexual identity life after life. We've all been men, we've all been women, we've all been transgendered, we've all been homosexual. We've all been heterosexual. We've all been pansexual. We've all been trisexual. Let's try anything. I mean, we explore these things as soul. These are all experiences that we all pass through in one life or another. We've all had lifetimes in which we've been addicted to certain substances. We've all had lifetimes of loneliness and depression and where we've been abused and misused. Have to realize that we have gone through all experiences. And if one is still lurking out there that we have a real problem with, that we're judging, that will be the next in the lineup of our experiences. Because if you judge it, it means you don't understand it. It means you've not brought the loving gaze to look at that and see it for what it is, which means then you have to experience it Why? To develop compassion. So, there's always going to be some issue or problem. People think that they have to wait until there's no problems or issues to be happy. If you wait for that, you'll wait for life after life after life because life is problematic. Everything in life poses a difficulty, a challenge, a problem, something to be worked through. But when you move from presence, when you move from the living love that you are, you live above the problem. You don't notice those things very much. You handle what's in front of you and you keep going. You don't attach to it. You don't even remember it after a while because you're living at another level where other things you're noticing are more important, like the presence of the living love that's sourcing through you, which gives you an intensely blissful feeling. It's very joyous to serve your divine function. So it may be very difficult for some of you to imagine, but there are people who actually enjoy their suffering, their poor health, or other things that they would look to the outward gaze to be suffering. I remember my husband brought home a homeless man one time and put him on our couch. We had a one-bedroom apartment. So he was literally everywhere. There was no place you could go where he wasn't because we had a very small apartment. And he said, never feel sorry for someone who's homeless because they want that experience. They want to have that experience. They want the freedom to not be bound to having to pay a mortgage and utilities and do this and do that. Moreover, he said, we have a society so that we know exactly which food bin to go to behind the supermarkets for example, they throw out the produce or the cheese or the this or the that. He had it all down to a science. And where to go for a shower, and where to go to shave, and where, you know, he had it all worked out. And he said, Thanksgiving's coming up, and I want to go and forage for everything we're going to have for our Thanksgiving dinner. Are you up for it? And we said, sure. So he left, came back later with bags and bags and bags of produce and vegetables and fruits and all sorts of stuff that he had gotten out of the garbage containers. And we had that for our Thanksgiving dinner. So it opened my eyes to a whole new way of allowing souls to have the experience that they need to have to get to where they need to go in their life. So we can't pass an outer judgment on what people are going through. That's not to say you don't help them. That's not to say that you don't go out of your way when someone is in your way to offer whatever assistance you can. But also remember that they have responsibility for living their life according to how they are being guided to live it. And no one's a victim. No one's a victim. Everyone has invented the story that they're living out. Everyone essentially is the divine dreamer, dreaming these dreams of separation from all goodness and all love. But you know, it's such a wonderful feeling when in the midst of a bad dream, you awaken and you can laugh, oh, it was just a dream. There's such a joy when you've been really, really lost to all of a sudden be found, or to awaken and find that you weren't lost at all at your home, just having a dream of being lost. And there's nothing more wonderful to awaken to the truth that you are immortal divine love, forever one with divine source. My goodness, it's worth everything to have those experiences, which we would never have if we didn't go through this life that we have in these worlds and universes that are governed by duality and polarity and adversarial energy, opposing forces. We need to have that. That's part of our return to joy. So, letting go the need to control outcome in life is such an enormous relief. You'll feel the heavy burdens of stress and worry and anxiety simply roll off your shoulders with the letting go of control. And as you let go of the need and imperative to control, which you can't ever do anyway, you'll notice your headaches and your migraines and your ulcers and your digestive disorders and other physical, emotional, and mental problems suddenly clear up. The desire to control plays havoc with the solar plexus and thus gives rise to digestive processes that are adversely affected. Mental resistance to what is taking place causes tension in the head, and that can lead to headaches, or even worse, it can lead to strokes. Tension in the solar plexus and head affects the blood pressure, and thus the heart, and can lead to a whole array of maladies. Therefore, even to keep physically healthy requires keeping calmly centered in the divine presence, taking care of what you need to do, but leaving the outcome and the results up to the divine spirit to resolve. So, there was a great, I would say, realized being in the 10th century, an Indian mystic by the name of Tilopa. And he gave instructions for transcending the egoic mind. And there were six of them. And they go like this. Let go of the past. Let go of concern about what may come. Let go of what is happening now. Let go of trying to figure anything out. Let go of trying to make anything happen. Relax right now and rest. Now, don't you want to heave a sigh of relief? I sure do. So relax in present nowness and rest in the divine presence. I like to say, rest like a planet rests in space. Let go and yield yourself like a leaf borne aloft by the wind. Just get a sense of being upheld by divine love. There's a lesson in the Course of Miracles that says, I rest in God. I am sustained by the love of God. That's an actual fact. Everything is upheld and sustained by divine love throughout the cosmos. So once you, this is another thing that happens, once you've refined and spiritualized your life and lifestyle to where it's well nigh perfect, and you're feeling pretty good about yourself, I might add, which again lends itself to your ego and your vanity and your self-importance and your superiority. So don't get too high on your perfected lifestyle, because then you'll need to let go of all those attachments as well. Your attachment to being perfect, your attachment to being impeccable, your attachment to being so spiritual, your attachment to being a vegetarian or a celibate or whatever you've accorded as the ideal. You've got to give over those attachments as well. So at some point, all of those rules and regulations, all those shoulds, all those have-tos have to go out the door. You've got to jettison the whole cargo. I remember back in the early 70s when I was studying and teaching from the Alice Bailey and Tibetan Master DK's books, that the early emphasis was very strong that one had to be a vegetarian, primarily to overcome the animal impulses and the desire body or the astral tendencies that one had to master in order to pass through the first and second degrees of initiation. The first degree, you have to master the physical appetites, the physical body, physical elemental. The second initiation, you have to master the astral body. They're very difficult to do. And so the recommendation was that you would not have meat or eggs. And most of the ashrams, you know, in India are very strict about that. And also celibacy. You know, unless you're married, you know, to maintain continence and celibacy, sexual celibacy. So later on, as I was reading one of the more advanced discussions for already accepted disciples and initiates, the Master DK said that no true disciple required vegetarianism nor any other ism, that the preliminary instructions were to demonstrate to yourself your control over your appetites, but that at some point it also revealed the tendency to feel superior because, for example, you were a vegetarian and other people weren't, or you were continent and other people were sleeping around. You know, it gave rise to feeling like you were more spiritual. So it revealed again the weakness of the ego to go into vanity and self-importance and pride. Spiritual pride is one of the worst things that we could, you know, lay upon ourselves. So at one stage of the path, maybe that's advisable. At another stage of the path, it's not. And the Master DK even went on to say that in the early stages, when we use a lot of protective techniques, we'll use the light to surround us and protect us, and we'll do all these prayers and all of these things, that we are building, again, walls of separation, which at some point we must dismantle and dissolve. So whatever barriers we place between ourselves and anything, at some point, is perpetrating that old heresy that we are separate from one another, from God, from whatever. And we're going to have to dissolve every single separative notion that we have perpetrated. Oh, it may seem like a good thing. Okay, you're vegetarian, you're celibate, you use the light. You place the light before you. You surround yourself with the light. You call in the light. You do all that stuff. And then at some point, all you've done is create and reinforce more and more of an idea that you're separate. And there's always that tendency of feeling that you're more spiritual because you know these things and do these things, and most people have never even given those a second thought. Another thing is that very, very, very highly developed souls sometimes don't show any outer interest at all and what we're talking about right now. They've been there, done that, bought the beanie. They're not interested in this lifetime. So what you'll see a very, very advanced soul do, they'll be engaged in some form of contribution to society and to the world that benefits very large masses and aggregates of people. They take on very large arenas of responsibility. And that's why you can look at someone that's very effective on an international level, and you'll generally see a very advanced soul, maybe a high initiate, probably not a master, because masters usually are hidden behind the scenes. But they'll be working, their influence will be working through their disciples in the world. I don't know, that may be shifting now that so many of the masters are moving into the outer world to live amongst us. It's hard to say what form of expression they'll have. But one thing you can be sure, they will never, ever engage in an action in which they are not embodying pure divine love and hosting the full divine presence. So you'll see the divine presence being hosted. You'll see the evidence in selfless service. And you'll see unconditional divine love and compassion through that individual. I think we have two extremely good examples of that on the planet right now. We have the Dalai Lama, who's the very embodiment of unconditional divine love, forgiveness, compassion, humor, grounded common sense, and genuine humility. And Pope Francis is no slouch either. You'll find another man that will not allow doctrine and dogma to control him. He makes his own decisions, and he lives very humbly and simply. Didn't want to wear the fancy robes, didn't want to live in the Vatican. Lives in the hermitage with the other monks. And has earned, I would say, the respect, irregardless of religious affiliation, of a large majority of the world. So it's by their fruits that you know who they are, what they are. And remember that morality can only occur when we are hosting the divine presence and we're living and expressing through unconditional, selfless, pure love. The minute the ego enters into an action, it is sullied. There's some element of missing the mark or sin or immorality. And so if you begin to discern morality by the manifestation of the truth of one's being, which again is divine love, without need, without greed, you will then see the manifestation of a genuinely moral life, or dharmic life, another way to phrase it, or a life of genuine right action or righteousness. We can call it different things, but it looks the same. Spirituality is simply living in love. And that always produces a positive effect, no matter what the action is, no matter what the behavior, no matter how it's presented. When the intention is in alignment with that divine love, the outcome blesses everything. The whole collective is lifted. So at some point, we must dissolve all otherness into the allness. And we will realize that God alone is all that is. And I am that I am. So I hope this has been helpful to you. It's very quintessential to realize the simplicity that true love is simply the presence of the invisible, formless, divine, and the evidence of its presence and manifestation. So let's go out chanting on I Hu. Deep breath. Raise your hands, palms out, and just allow that divine presence and that living love that is your true essence to flow out to your hands and bless this entire planet. Bless all worlds and all beings, all life forms, everywhere. May they all awaken to the love that they are. And may they all let go of the control that is simply another face of fear. May all surrender into that divine loving that is the truth of us all. Namaste.